readers, welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles. Turn on the TV or log onto the landing page of your email, and you're inundated with celebrity news that you couldn't care less about. Justin Bieber, Miley Cyrus, the Kardashians. Really, I don't need to hear one more thing about that family, ever. Today, let's dig into new biographies about people who we actually care about. Iconic musicians, legendary actors, tycoons, and politicians. Their stories are fascinating and offer up unexpected perspectives on people you'd like to know more about. My guest today is a rock journalist who traveled with the Rolling Stones, attended the major concerts and parties of the era, and became a confidant to rock's biggest names. Find out what the buzz is all about as we turn to page one of the Book Report. First on the Book Report's play sheet, a new look at the Allman Brothers. For 25 years, Alan Paul has covered the band, conducting hundreds of interviews, riding buses with them, attending rehearsals, and countless shows. For his new bio, One Way Out, The Inside History of the Allman Brothers Band, Paul interviewed every living band member, plus managers, roadies, and contemporaries, including Eric Clapton, Bob Weir, and many others. Tracking the band's career from their 1969 formation to today, One Way Out is filled with musical and cultural insights, tales of sometimes violent personality conflicts and betrayals, drug and alcohol use, murder allegations and exoneration, tragic early deaths, road stories, and an in-depth look at the acrimonious parting in 2000 with founding guitarist Dickie Betts. Dan John Miller narrates.
In the summer of 1966, we packed our gear in the back of our guitar player and singer Scott Boyer's car and headed to Daytona Beach to make it big. Well, that bombed big time. We auditioned at all of the clubs there, and they all thought we were the best band they had ever heard, but the universal rejections came because you can't dance to it. We were doing our last audition at a place called the Martinique when in walked the Beatles. Of course, it wasn't actually John, Paul, George, and Ringo, but the way people acted, it may as well have been. It was a band called the Allman Joys, and walking in the lead was this dude with long blonde hair, followed closely by another dude with even longer and blonder hair. This was, of course, Dwayne and Greg Allman. We played our set and got the usual, "You guys are great, but they can't dance to it," from the club owner. Waiting for us backstage, however, were those two blonde guys, and they were blown away with what we had just played. We explained our predicament and got an invite to come hang out at 100 Van Avenue, where they lived with their mother, Mama A. After a few days, we packed it up, stuck our tails between our legs, and headed back to Jacksonville, where a few weeks later, I got a call from Dwayne asking me to come to a club in downtown Jacksonville because their drummer had just quit. I, of course, said, "I'm on my way." I played with them for a night or two, and Dwayne, knowing that this club's owner was a huge Dylan fan, got our band an audition, and we took over the Allman Joys gig. That lasted for around 8 months. Then we hit the Southern Club circuit, where we would run into Dwayne and Greg from time to time. Sometime in, I believe, 1967, we were in Daytona and stopped by 100 Van Avenue and found Dwayne and Greg, fresh from a run at the big time in L.A. as the Hourglass. We decided to join forces and played for the next few months as the Bitter End, the Hourglass, or the 31st of February. We had signed a record contract with Vanguard Records, and the Bitter End Club in New York would not let us use that name. We took this version to Miami to record our second record for Vanguard. You can hear two of those recordings on Dwayne's retrospective, Skydog. One of them was the very first recording of Melissa. When we finished there, Greg flew back to L.A. and found out that the Hourglass's record company, Liberty, which has no relation to the current label of the same name, would release the rest of that band from their contracts if he would stay and record solo. I was with Dwayne in Daytona when he got the call from Greg. I believe if Dwayne could have gotten through the phone, he would have strangled Greg on the spot. Well, Dwayne had been offered a gig as a studio player in Muscle Shoals, and without Greg, he just didn't feel like our band was going to go anywhere. So he packed it up and headed to Alabama. Back to my opening sentence. Luckily for me, before I enrolled in college again, there came a knock on my door, and there was Dwayne with an incredible-looking black man. Dwayne, in his usual way, introduced us to each other as J-Mo, his new drummer, and Butch, his old drummer. He hung around for a while and then took off to meet up with Barry Oakley at the house on Riverside Drive, where Barry's then band, Second Coming, was living. He left J-Mo at my house, and for the first time in my middle-class white life, I had to get to know and deal with a black man. It changed me profoundly. Over 44 years later, J-Mo and I are still best of friends, and I am very proud to call him my brother. I could go on with this story for several hundred pages, but that is what Alan Paul has written, and that is what I am writing a foreword for. I will let Alan tell the story of the Allman Brothers Band, as he has been able to uncover it from many long interviews with me and everyone else that he could get to, who was there during many of the band's incarnations. There have been several attempts to write the epic rock and roll story, but so far, I haven't read anything that really gets it. They tend to be written by newspaper writers, and the books wind up being very long articles that deal with who did what, where, and when. None have delved into the how and why. I've read Alan Paul's articles about us going back many years. I've read his book, Big in China, and the one thing that jumps from those pages is how and why.
That was One Way Out by Alan Paul. Lisa Robinson is a contributing editor at Vanity Fair, where she's produced all the music issues and written the key music pieces over the last 10 years. She was a longtime music columnist for the New York Post and several rock magazines that defined the music scene in the 1970s. A pioneering female journalist in what was then an exclusive boys' club, Lisa traveled with the Stones, Led Zeppelin, and others, and was a confidant of John Lennon, Patti Smith, U2, and Michael Jackson. She introduced Lou Reed to David Bowie. She's the reason why Elvis Costello and The Clash got record deals. The book goes on to offer up an insider's look at Eminem, Lady Gaga, and Jay-Z. Today, we'll speak with Lisa about her new book, There Goes Gravity, A Life in Rock and Roll, which some critics have called an all-access pass to the golden age of rock. Welcome, Lisa, and thanks for joining us on the Book Report.
Thank you for having me.
Early on in the book, you describe your difference as a music journalist. You were not a critic, and you wrote gossipy columns. In fact, Mick Jagger said your writing was not bitchy enough. How did your career evolve?
My career just happened. It was really like what Keith Richards says is a lucky accident. You know, it was a time when things really just happened and you could hang out. My husband at the time was writing a syndicated column. He was on the radio. He had a column in England. I write about this in the book in detail. He didn't want to write the column anymore. He turned it over to me, and one thing after another just sort of fell into place.
Right. When you traveled with the Stones, you shared it was Keith who interested you the most. How so?
Keith was the most elusive and the most mysterious, and I always wanted to do the interview that was the harder one to get. It was the same thing, basically, with Led Zeppelin. Jimmy Page was that way. Even when I was on the road much later with Van Halen, Eddie Van Halen was that way. I mean, it tended to be the one who was more on drugs, who was a little more mysterious and elusive. And at that time, Keith just kept to himself, and he didn't do a lot of press, and Mick sort of bore the burden of all of that. But of course, that made Keith much more fascinating to me. And then years later, when Keith kicked heroin, and you really could find out what he was like, and I spent hours and hours with him over 20 years talking, and he's just incredibly insightful and lucid and brilliant and funny and wonderful.
Let's talk about drugs for a moment. Well, they muse how drugs impacted the music of the 70s. Would the music have been the same had there not been those excesses? What's your feeling?
I have absolutely no idea. You know, there are many musicians who felt that a lot of those drugs fueled their creativity, especially psychedelics, maybe marijuana. I certainly don't feel that any hard drugs ever made anybody any better. certainly not heroin and certainly not cocaine. People were babbling idiots on cocaine. I never found it to be attractive. I never tried it. I never wanted to. It just wasn't part of my relationship to this world. You know, there were times when I was on a completely different tour because I was really there for the music. I wasn't there for the party.
Right. You once asked Mick Jagger what was the most important thing in a rock band, and he answered the drummer. So talk about John Bonham.
John Bonham was, I think, the best drummer ever in rock and roll because he just had an incredible feel. He was influenced by Motown. He was influenced by R&B. I mean, now I could name many, many other drummers who I think are incredible. Questlove and The Roots, I think, is amazing. Steve Jordan is amazing. Charlie Watts is a great drummer, more of a jazz drummer. But John Bonham was very, very underrated at the time. He also did that 20-minute solo Moby Dick that I could have lived without because I wasn't ever a big fan of drum solos. But at the time, and I write about this a lot in the book, he was in a fury because he came in after Karen Carpenter in a Playboy drummer poll. I think it was in 1975, and he was really, his feelings were really hurt by that. And John Bonham had the reputation of being like sort of a maniac. When he got drunk or stoned, he was wild and violent. But I knew him to be a really sweet guy. When he did an interview with me once, he came, knocked on my hotel room door, and he was wearing a suit. And at the time, he would always open car doors for me and light cigarettes for me. And I just was incredibly fond of him.
We're speaking with Lisa Robinson on The Book Report. Jimmy Page and John Paul Jones were so gifted. Why do you think the rock press played down their influence and seemed to really have it against Led Zeppelin?
When Led Zeppelin first came to America, they were really considered a cheesy heavy metal band by a lot of my so-called colleagues who were very, very serious rock critics. But when I saw them for the first time in Jacksonville, Florida, I think it was in 1973, I fell in love with their music because I heard all these different influences. I heard the blues, I heard Eastern music, I heard the incredible string band, Kaleidoscope, folk music, Joni Mitchell, Fairport Convention, and because I was so informed about all this music, when I sat down and talked to them, and I started talking about all these different influences, that immediately impressed them, I guess, to the point where they felt that I was a kindred spirit, and I got what they were trying to do, and that's why they had me around them as much as they did.
It was amusing to read in your book that in the mid-70s, some of the bands, several of which are still touring today, were being written about then as being washed up. In your
opinion, dinosaurs, yes. Rolling Stones, Led Zeppelin, Who, Pink Floyd, all of them, because of punk rock, I think, because what happened in the mid-70s when all the punk rock bands cut their hair and it was very loud, fast, noisy music, all of them just kind of, you know, it's like similar to like what happened in the 1990s when Nirvana and Soundgarden and Pearl Jam came along. It just made all those other bands like Warrant and Poison and those Bang Tangos, those kind of bands, it just put them out of business. Now, it didn't put the Stones and the Who out of business or Led Zeppelin, Lord knows, because their music certainly has withstood the test of time and they're still performing and people still want to see them. But there was a moment there where those bands, even when they were in their 30s, got nervous.
Yeah. Well, time told a different story. I was fascinated to read that Michael Jackson had a completely different voice when talking in public. He actually spoke normally. Did you ever ask him why he employed that affectation?
You know, I never really did because when I spoke to him, he spoke normally. And then occasionally I would hear him go off into that sort of higher, whispery thing. I think it was just both sides of his personality. It really never occurred to me so much until I looked back at it or I listened back to some of my tapes and I wrote about it for this book that certainly when he talked to a lawyer or a record company executive, he was much more forceful. He was very much in control of his career. He knew what he was doing.
You know, in the book, you seem to be a bit conflicted about Bono in that he embraced the music. They didn't want to be sort of the establishment. And then years later, he's up for the Nobel Peace Prize and living in the south of France. Talk about that.
Well, I've always had an issue with Bono because of his association with President Bush. I always felt that artists should not go to that White House. And we argued about it all the time, although Bono would always say it wasn't an argument, it was a debate. And I have a lot about this in the book. He said to me, Irish people debate, we don't argue. And we just always agreed to disagree about it. I don't know that it's a question of being a member of the establishment, because he's still an artist, he's still a musician, he's a songwriter, he's a performer. But, you know, I do go into this a lot in the book about the stages of success that bands have, from stage one to stage four, when they start off driving in a van or sleeping on people's floors, and then by the time they get to stage four, they're in the private planes with the grass-fed beef and the private chefs and the trainers and the trunks of costumes. And I just trace the trajectory of that.
Yeah. Lisa, the book was really fascinating. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you very much for having me.
All righty. Bye. And now let's hear a sampling of There Goes Gravity, A Life in Rock and Roll, performed by the author.
Chapter 1. It was 3 in the morning on July 5th, 1975, and I was just falling asleep when the phone rang in my Memphis hotel room. Mick Jagger was on the line, and he was slurring his words. "Listen," he said, "I'm with 2 girls, and they've got a cute guy with them, and I'm trying to get a girl for him because he's lonesome. He's not here right now. He's got his own room. I just thought you might be interested." I declined. "Well," he said, not skipping a beat, "who should we call? He's 30 years old, and he's not bad-looking. He's American, and he just wants a little company. I've got the room list in front of me." He proceeded to run down the names of all the women on that 1975 summer tour, picked someone, and suggested I call her girl to girl. I told him he should call. We hung up. I went back to sleep. I will always remember 1973 as the year that Eugene from Sinandra ruined my summer because he cut my hair too short. That summer, I also met Mick Jagger for the first time. It was at Nassau Coliseum at an Eric Clapton concert. I knew Richard Cole from traveling with Led Zeppelin. He was Eric's tour manager, and he placed me at the side of the stage. Mick was there too, and within minutes he sidled, there is no other word for it, over to me, and in a very high, campy, Monty Pythonish voice said, "Jimmy Page was wearing a pink satin jacket." This was how I knew he had read things I wrote, either in the British Music Weekly, the New Musical Express, or my Eleganza column in Cream magazine. To him, I said that his shoes, sequin-covered Papagallos, or more likely Repettos, were tacky. Later that night, after Eric's show, Mick, Eric's manager Robert Stigwood, Richard Cole and I hung out at the Plaza Hotel's Oak Bar and gossiped for hours, mostly about how Mick wouldn't share his costume ideas with David Bowie. By 1975, I had traveled with and written about Led Zeppelin. The New Musical Express was read by all the English musicians and, more importantly, because their children were musicians, their parents. The band, Zeppelin especially, wanted their families to know how big they were in America. I also spent many, many nights in the winter of 1974 at CBGB's with Patti Smith, the Ramones, and television, writing about the scenes behind what was always incorrectly referred to as the New York punk rock scene. Having one foot in the big-time Led Zeppelin camp and all the access and trust that had come with it, and the other foot in deep at CBGB's, is, I am certain, what made me different as a music journalist. Also, I wasn't a critic. I wrote gossipy columns and conducted interviews. This was somewhat of a rarity in the early 1970s when rock journalism was in its infancy and mostly populated by boys who had ambitions to become the next Norman Mailer. In 1975, Mick Jagger was concerned. The English press had called the Stones, along with the Who and the Faces, a dinosaur band. The fact that the Stones had carted Lee Radziwill, Truman Capote, and Andy Warhol around the country with them on their 1972 tour didn't help. That tour, which became known as the Stones' Jet Set Tour, positioned the band, who just 4 or 5 years prior had been considered rebels, as aging rockers. Then. While he claimed otherwise, Mick was ever mindful of the press and public opinion. He wanted to appear in touch. Jane Rose, now Keith Richards' longtime manager, was, at that time, working for the Stones' tour manager, Peter Rudge. She recommended to Mick that I help him navigate the rock press. Mick was determined that the 1975 Tour of the Americas, which affectionately became known as TODA, be different. He got Giorgio Sanangelo to design his costumes, and indeed, costumes they were. The Broadway stage and lighting designers Jules Fisher and Robin Wagner, who had done the production for David Bowie's Diamond Dogs tour, helped design the band's elaborate stage. And he stole the makeup artist Pierre LaRoche away from David Bowie. In 1975, when punk was peaking, just having a makeup person on tour, unless you were Bowie or deeply involved with the fading glam rock scene, was telling.
We've just heard There Goes Gravity by Lisa Robinson. Actor Rob Lowe is an entertaining raconteur whose best-selling first book, Stories I Only Tell My Friends, an autobiography, was hailed by the New York Times as self-deprecatingly funny. Now, his new title, Love Life, serves up another delicious selection of his intimate stories and observations. After his acclaimed writing debut, Lowe felt he had more stories to share and more family to introduce. The result is a touching memoir about the business of acting, the pitfalls of success, family, love, and more. Lowe, who narrates, describes what it's like in the trenches as both the star and producer of a flop TV show. How a visit as a 20-year-old to Hugh Hefner's Playboy Mansion led to a surprise in the hot tub. How an actor prepares for his role, as well as the practical, boots-on-the-ground details no drama or film school could ever teach you.
My brother Chad and I were rummaging around our pal Danny's treehouse-like cottage he shared with his single mom. I was 13. My brother and his friend were around 9. I had taken to co-opting my brother's friends in those early days after our arrival in Malibu because 13-year-olds thought the boys who wanted to act were probably queer, but 9-year-olds had no such judgments about my career aspirations. Chad and I had always been close, bonded by a tumultuous cross-country uprooting and the divorce that instigated it, and if he resented my glomming onto his friends, he never showed it. Chad, Danny, and I spent our free time attempting to shoot the hill on Larkspur Lane on our skateboards and hiding perishable items among the shelves of our local market to monitor them as they rotted and began to stink. Danny's mom worked at the checkout counter, and every boy I knew had a confused, early adolescent, dim-witted crush on her. With her sandy hair, light eyes, and girlish body, it was often hard to reconcile her hippy-dippy surfer babe looks with the fact that she was our buddy's mother. Like so many in the post-Woodstock, pre-AIDS, ERA, and Est-driven era of mid-70s Malibu, Danny's mom was no stranger to countercultural mores. After school one day, as the three of us sat eating her homemade avocado pie, she asked my 9-year-old brother if he wanted to be smoked out. Chad looked at me with what today would be called a WTF look, having no idea what was being offered to him. We knew that Danny was a cannabis early adopter, but Chad and I were still sons of the Midwest. We were petrified of drugs. So far. We were in the minority. If there's one thing that a newly transplanted misfit teen doesn't want to be, it's that. Standing on the outside of a peer circle. So, after observing the popular kids whipping out their bongs and pipes after a tough day at Woodshop or Madrigal's, I knew what I had to do to ingratiate myself to my fellow 13-year-olds. I hopped on the bus to Malibu's only record store for a little shopping spree. I always liked riding the bus. Because I rode them frequently into Hollywood for my auditions, I knew most of the drivers by name. I particularly liked the ones who let my friends and me hang upside down like monkeys from the overhead safety bars, swinging wildly as we sped down the Pacific Coast Highway. At the record shop, standing in front of the glass case containing the various dope-smoking accoutrements, I decided on a tiny, pocket-sized wooden pop pipe, mostly because it looked like one of Captain Kirk's phasers from Star Trek. And, in truth, over the coming weeks, I got more use of it as a toy, running through the sage-scented gullies and swales of the Malibu Hills, pretending to be shooting Klingons, than I did using it for its intended purpose. Because my dark secret was that I hated pot. My prop pipe did the trick, and I didn't have to smoke at the bus stop in the morning to be cool. I would pull it out of my pocket and brandish it like I was Bob Marley, and eventually the other kids would be too stoned to notice that I never actually used it. I suppose it was an early bit of acting on my part, and it got results. Presenting a facade would become a tool that I would use to cope with the necessity of fitting in, to poor effect, up until my mid-20s. Malibu, in the mid to late 70s, was a breeding ground for many artists who would shape the next decade. There were other young actors to come out of that time and place, and I think it had a lot to do with being surrounded by an unrelenting fusillade of characters and quacks. This may have been the reason why my mother chose Malibu as our new home in the first place.
We've just heard Love Life by Rob Lowe. Millions of viewers know Bob Saget from his role as the sweetly neurotic dad of Full House and as the wisecracking host of America's Funniest Home Videos. And then there are the legions of fans who adore his scatological, out-of-his-mind stand-up routines, comedy specials, and outrageously profane performances in such shows as HBO's Entourage. In Dirty Daddy, the chronicles of a family man turned filthy comedian, Saget, who performs the book, continues to embrace his dark side. Yes, Bob believes there's a time and a place for filth. From his never-before-heard stories of what went on behind the scenes with co-stars John Stamos and Mary-Kate and Ashley Olsen, to his tales of legendary friends and colleagues like Rodney Dangerfield, Richard Pryor, and Don Rickles, Saget opens up about his personal experiences with his original blend of silliness, vulgarity, humor, and heart.
Look, there's no easy way to segue into this. What I'm about to describe is some painful stuff. Life's interesting. Sometimes your heart gets broken. My heart's been broken several times, and not that long ago. It may be broken again by the time this book goes to paperback, and again for the audiobook. I'm not telling you anything that's not the obvious. We all go through pain and heartache. It's part of the journey. Just when we think we're on the upswing and have achieved some kind of breakthrough or closure, something else hits. It's like the family I once heard about who left California because they were scared of earthquakes and moved to Colorado, where a massive boulder fell on their house. That son of a coyote. Our destiny is not usually what we expect it to be. I've known lots of people who've tried to plan exactly how things would turn out for them, and then when life didn't go according to plan, they ended up in denial. They just couldn't accept that their endpoint was different than what they'd envisioned. Acceptance of endings has been pretty difficult for me, too. It's painful for me right now just to end this paragraph. There's a great quote about the difficulty of endings that comes directly from movie star and occasional hero Tom Cruise. He said, "Nothing ends nicely. That's why it ends." That's true of a relationship for sure, but the quote could also apply to the end of a life. That's right, I'm using a Tom Cruise quote to introduce my personal stories of loss. You always have to be careful to choose the right Tom Cruise quote. If you're looking at your father in a coffin, and up comes your uncle, Ralph Cramden style, yelling into the casket, "Show me the money, baby," I'd say that's not the appropriate quote for the moment. Maybe that's where the expression "cry uncle" came from. I looked up the roots of the expression "cry uncle," and it involves being tickled by a friend to the point of begging for help from your uncle. So the Cruise quote was, "Nothing ends nicely." Sometimes a person's life does in fact end relatively nicely compared to how it could have ended, especially if there's suffering involved. And for people you care deeply about, the less suffering they have to go through, the better. Having lost quite a few people over the years, I know that when someone dies or is dying, you just want to ease their pain, even end it if you can. That's why euthanasia can be simpler than divorce. Oh, wait, I didn't type that. But wait, you read it, so I must have. Silly me. Or maybe if you read like I do, you just skimmed, and so it didn't register and I'm safe. I've been talking a lot with my friends lately about death and divorce. I've been obsessed with these subjects for years, actually. Sometimes it seems like death, the finality of it, is easier to go through than a breakup. I wouldn't imagine most people share that opinion, yet I've found when I bring it up among friends, they understand exactly what I'm talking about, or seem to, until they storm out of the dinner party crying. It's not an easy subject, death. It's up there with politics and religion, in that it tends to lead to some pretty heated discussion. If, say, you are dating someone, and you have plans to possibly have sex with them, do not bring up death, unless the person you're dating is an undertaker, in which case you just found your way in. Inevitably, going back through our lives and remembering people we've lost makes us think of our own mortality. When I was a teenager, having a different uncle die every couple years, I never pictured myself making it past my 50s. Then losing my two sisters so young, I felt even more like a sword of Damocles was hanging over my head. When was it going to be my turn?
That was Dirty Daddy by Bob Saget. With a career spanning more than five decades, Robert Wagner is uniquely qualified to recount the glamorous holiday era of the late 40s and early 50s. You Must Remember This is Wagner's ode to Tinseltown's bygone age, its incomparable style, and its legendary stars. Wagner, who performs the book, revisits the houses, restaurants, and other haunts of Hollywood's elite, offering an intimate view of their lives on and off the screen. He fondly recounts mythic figures entertaining at home among friends, away from the publicity machine and the public eye. Wagner also discusses Hollywood's evolution from an industry dominated by moguls to one run by agents.
I've always believed that Elizabeth was a terribly underrated actress, and I've always known that she was among the most generous people alive, not just with money, but with the most valuable commodity any of us possesses, her time. But Elizabeth had her flaws, as we all do. Foremost among them was that she was oblivious to the concept of punctuality. A delay of 1 or 2 hours was normal for people waiting for Elizabeth. I've always wondered whether it was a passive-aggressive way of asserting herself for all those years of enforced punctuality at MGM, but she was never late on our picture. Unless she really, really liked you, Elizabeth was always late, and sometimes she was incredibly late even when she did like you. So I wasn't terribly shocked when even after the gopher arrived back at the church with the correct shoes, we were still sitting there. David Guest was growing noticeably perturbed, so he asked Michael Jackson to go find Elizabeth and bring her back alive. Neither David nor Liza wanted to personally force the issue, since they were so pleased that Elizabeth had agreed to come in the first place. Elizabeth was going through one of her bad phases, overweight and not looking good. Michael disappeared into the room where Elizabeth was supposedly getting ready while one of his bodyguards stood watch outside. And then we waited some more. By now, the wedding was an hour late and counting. I asked a man what the holdup was, but he just shrugged and said that Elizabeth was in a room with Michael Jackson. Nobody seemed to be moving, and nobody seemed eager to break up whatever was going on in the waiting room. Because I knew Elizabeth so well, I was finally deputized to get Michael away from her so the wedding could proceed. Otherwise, we all might find ourselves growing old very slowly at the Marble Collegiate Church. I walked past the bodyguard and into the room. Elizabeth was sitting there gazing at Michael. Michael was on his knees gazing at Elizabeth. He was holding her hand. Nothing was being said. He was besotted with her. He was drinking her in. Michael, I said, we've got to get the wedding started. We have to get going. I want to be with Elizabeth, Michael said in that weird whispery voice. I love Elizabeth. Talking to Michael when he was in one of his reveries was exactly like talking to a 6-year-old waiting up for Santa Claus. You didn't want to disabuse him of his fantasy, but you had to firmly lead him away from the Christmas tree so that the presents could be put out. I love her too, Michael, I said. We all love her. But we have to go ahead with the wedding. There's a church full of people out there, and they're getting restless. You can spend all the time you want with Elizabeth after the wedding. Full disclosure, I was angry, so I might have said all this a little brusquely. By this time, I was heartily sick of the wedding, even though it hadn't even taken place yet. What I wanted to do was to have a drink with Bob Osborne and not be bothered by infantile. I got them moving, but Elizabeth came out on the wrong side of the church. The guests were divided into men on the left and women on the right, so she had to walk all the way around behind the pews. Since Elizabeth was fairly immobile and walked with difficulty, part of it was with her back, part of it was with the medication for her back, which always gave her a bit of a buzz. So she had to be helped onto the altar. Finally, the wedding got underway. David gave Liza a 3.5-carat diamond ring from Tiffany's. After the minister said he could kiss the bride, David tried to suck the lips off Eliza's face. I was too appalled to say anything. Jill said, ooh. Next to her, Liz Smith said, double ooh. The reception afterwards was huge. Andy Williams sang. Gloria Gaynor sang. Michael Jackson gave the toast. I noticed some people I hadn't noticed at the wedding. Kirk Douglas, Joan Collins, and Sid Luft, one of Liza's stepfathers. Elizabeth skipped the reception. I finally had my drink with Bob Osborne.
You've just heard You Must Remember This by Robert Wagner with Scott Eyman. The Hiltons, The True Story of an American Dynasty by J. Randy Taraborelli, is a sweeping saga of the success and excess of an iconic American family. Patriarch Conrad Hilton's visionary ideas and unyielding will established the model for the modern luxury hotel industry. But outside the boardroom, Conrad struggled with emotional detachment, failed marriages, and conflicted Catholicism. Then there were his children, like playboy Nicky Hilton's tragic alcoholism and marriage to Elizabeth Taylor. Baron Hilton, on the other hand, deftly handled his father's legacy, carrying the Hilton brand triumphantly into the new millennium. Eric, raised apart from his older brothers, accepted his supporting role in the Hilton dynasty with calm and quiet, a stark contrast to the boy's much younger half-sister, Francesca, whose battle for recognition led her into courtrooms and conflict. The cast of supporting players includes Zsa Zsa Gabor, who is married to Conrad briefly and remained a thorn in his side for decades, and a host of other Hollywood and business luminaries with whom the Hiltons crossed paths and swords over the years. Robert Petkoff narrates.
Since arriving on the SS President Grant, overcrowded with refugees such as herself from Hungary almost 40 years earlier, Zsa Zsa had always known exactly what she wanted out of life. Success, happiness, wealth, the so-called American dream in all of its red, white, and blue splendor. She would do a lot to get it, too, as she would prove many times along the way, even if that meant marrying for prosperity, which she did more than a few times, including Conrad Hilton, 7 times to be exact. So far. Zsa Zsa's footsteps echoed sharply as she marched across the marble foyer of the Beverly Hills Hotel. She nodded at the concierge. He touched his cap in recognition. She then walked quickly down the red-carpeted hallway, past the famous Polo Lounge restaurant, out a pair of French doors, and then through a lovely flower garden in the direction of a nearby bungalow. As she entered the bungalow where her deposition was to be conducted, she immediately switched on her stage persona and played to the audience at hand. "My God, just look at all of these gorgeous men," she marveled as she swept grandly into the room. 4 attorneys and a male court reporter stood before her with big smiles. "I love being surrounded by gorgeous men," she enthused. "Everyone knows that about me by now." "Zsa Zsa, how wonderful to see you," said Myron Harpole as he emerged from the group to greet her. A solid Harvard Law School graduate in a fastidiously neat dark suit, he extended his hand to shake hers, but she brushed it aside and embraced him.
Myron, can you believe that we are here? She asked, looking around. Why, my Connie used to own this hotel.
A tangle of gold bracelets on each wrist made clinking noises every time she used her hands to express herself, which was often. No, my dear, actually he didn't, corrected the lawyer. He owned the Beverly Hilton Hotel, not the Beverly Hills Hotel.
She looked at him with a quizzical expression. No, I think he owned this one too, she insisted.
The lawyer smiled patiently and, with a small smile, shook his head no.
Well, I can't blame you for not knowing, she said with a dismissive wave. He owned so many hotels, who could keep track?
It was true. Zsa Zsa's ex-husband had either owned or managed luxury hotels all over the world, most of them, such as the famed Waldorf Astoria in New York City, which he considered the favorite among his legion, were extraordinary when it came not only to ambiance, but also to service. Hilton wanted his guests to be pampered and treated with the utmost respect. For him, it was as much a personal endeavor as it was professional. Therefore, a Hilton hotel would always be a cut above the competition, at least as long as Conrad Hilton had anything to say about it. Just as Zsa Zsa and Myron Harpole finished their conversation, another lawyer representing the Hilton estate, Ralph Nutter, entered the bungalow. He would be the one asking most of the questions on this day. He greeted Zsa Zsa and quickly took his seat. After Zsa Zsa was sworn in, the deposition began. The first subject raised had to do with the birth of Zsa Zsa's only daughter, Constance Francesca, known to all as Francesca. In preparation for what she suspected was coming, Zsa Zsa rummaged through a large leather handbag and extracted from it a copy of Francesca's birth certificate of March 10, 1947, in New York City.
That was The Hiltons by J. Randy Taraborelli. Many believe our final title was written to lay the groundwork for an upcoming presidential run. Hard Choices by Hillary Rodham Clinton is her hot-off-the-press inside account of the crises, choices, and challenges she faced during her 4 years as America's 67th Secretary of State, and how those experiences drive her view of the future. In the aftermath of her 2008 presidential run, Hillary expected to return to the U.S. Senate. To her surprise, Obama asked her to serve as his Secretary of State. This is the story of the 4 extraordinary years that followed, and the hard choices she and her colleagues confronted. Secretary Clinton and President Obama had to decide how to repair fractured alliances, wind down 2 wars, and address a global financial crisis. They faced a rising competitor in China, growing threats from Iran and North Korea, and revolutions across the Middle East. Along the way, they grappled with the decision to send Americans into harm's way, from Afghanistan to Libya to the hunt for Osama bin Laden. Secretary Clinton offers her views on what it will take for the U.S. to compete and thrive in an interdependent world. Hillary shares the narration with Kathleen Chalfant.
Why on earth was I lying on the back seat of a blue minivan with tinted windows? Good question. I was trying to leave my home in Washington, D.C. without being seen by the reporters staked out front. It was the evening of June 5, 2008, and I was heading to a secret meeting with Barack Obama, and not the one I had hoped for and expected until just a few months earlier. I had lost, and he had won. There hadn't been time yet to come to grips with that reality, but here we were. The presidential primary campaign was historic because of his race and my gender. But it had also been grueling, heated, long, and close. I was disappointed and exhausted. I had campaigned hard to the very end. But Barack had won, and now it was time to support him. The causes and people I had campaigned for, the Americans who had lost jobs and health care, who couldn't afford gas or groceries or college, who had felt invisible to their government for the previous 7 years, now depended on his becoming the 44th president of the United States. this was not going to be easy for me or for my staff and supporters who had given it their all. In fairness, it wasn't going to be easy for Barack and his supporters either. His campaign was as wary of me and my team as we were of them. There had been hot rhetoric and bruised feelings on both sides. And despite a lot of pressure from his backers, I had refused to quit until the last vote was counted. Barack and I had spoken 2 days earlier, late in the evening after the final primaries in Montana and South Dakota. "Let's sit down when it makes sense for you," he said. The next day, we crossed paths backstage at a long-scheduled conference for the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee in Washington. While a bit awkward, it gave our closest aides a chance to begin discussing details about a meeting. For me, that was my traveling chief of staff, Huma Abedin, the savvy, indefatigable, and gracious young woman who had worked for me since my time in the White House. For Obama, it was Reggie Love, the former Duke University basketball player who rarely left Barack's side. Huma and Reggie had kept open a line of communication even during the most intense days of the campaign, a hotline of sorts, in part because after every primary, no matter who won, either Barack or I called the other to concede and offer congratulations. We exchanged calls that were cordial, sometimes even lighthearted, since at least one person on the line had reason to be in a good mood. But more than a few calls were curt, just checking the box. Football coaches meet midfield after a game, but they don't always hug. We needed a place away from the media spotlight to meet and talk. So I called my good friend, Senator Dianne Feinstein of California, to ask if we could use her Washington home. I'd been there before and thought it would work well for us to come and go without drawing attention. The ruse succeeded. I slid around in the van's back seat as we took the sharp left turn at the end of my street onto Massachusetts Avenue, and I was on my way. I got there first. When Barack arrived, Dianne offered us each a glass of California Chardonnay and then left us in her living room, sitting in wing chairs facing each other in front of the fireplace. Despite our clashes over the past year, we had developed a respect for each other rooted in our shared experiences. Running for president is intellectually demanding, emotionally draining, and physically taxing. But crazy as a national campaign can be, it is our democracy in action, warts and all. Seeing that up close helped us appreciate each other for having gotten into the arena, as Theodore Roosevelt called it, and going all the way.
That was Hard Choices by Hillary Rodham Clinton. Dante wrote, "Worldly fame is but a breath of wind that blows now this way and now that, and changes names as it changes directions." So true, but the tales told today are certainly compelling. If memoirs are not your go-to genre, check my website, bookreportradio.com, for ideas on what to read next. Thanks so much for listening. Let's meet again in a week for the next edition of The Book Report.